Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Offbeat sounds for talented listeners. Broadcasts every other Wednesday at 10 p.m.
There was heaven, and there was earth.
Después de esa pieza, vamos a escuchar una comunicación simpática y cruel con ánimo.
That's Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Please, Mr. Redman, don't put me out in the street.
The Community Alliance of Tenants is working to increase awareness in Washington County of the statewide law SB 608 that was passed in early 2019. It limits rent increases and no-cause terminations for residential leases. There's a temporary bilingual English and Spanish hotline set up for Washington County renters with questions about SB 608, rent increases, no-cause termination notices, and or lease non-renewal notices. Phone number is 503-644-3007. Again, that's the Renter's Right Hotline phone number for Washington County every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. through January 30th at 503-644-3007. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm right in the middle of solving that riddle known as raising the rent.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Our in-depth guest today is Eva Hagberg Fisher, author of the new book, How to Be Loved, a memoir of life-saving friendship from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Eva's writing has appeared in the New York Times, Tin House, Wallpaper, Wired, and Jwell, and she holds degrees in architecture from UC Berkeley and Princeton, as well as a doctorate in visual and narrative culture from UC Berkeley. In the words of writer Jennifer Pasteloff, Eva Hagberg Fisher is a gift to this world. Her astute understanding of the way we work as humans and the way she can turn that understanding into compassion, love, and stories is something to behold. Her writing is necessary and heart-mending. Eva, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thank you so much.
Now, Eva, we first mentioned in the intro your degrees in architecture. Memoir writing's a little bit unrelated. And you still do consulting in the architecture field.
I do, and I still write about architecture. So I
wondered if you use some of that background in the planning and structuring of How to Be Loved.
Yeah, so you're wildly original, but you're not the first person to have pointed out that I have these two seemingly unrelated careers. But I graduated from college with this degree in architecture and wanted to write. And I had this sort of meteoric ascent as an architecture writer. And the process of learning how to write to deadline was extraordinarily useful when it came to writing a book. I had 15 years of practice of kind of getting over myself and not worrying so much and just realizing, you know, if I don't file this copy, the magazine goes to print with a hole in its pages. I can't do that. So I need to put aside whatever anxiety or stress or whatever, and I just need to write. I don't have a fear of the blank page. I don't have a fear of needing to edit drafts, you know, in the case of this book, 47 times. And so when I sold the book, I had a really pragmatic approach to it, which was that I had signed a contract, I'd cashed a check, I better deliver. And that professionalizing of what can I think often feel like it might be a scarily intimate or personal or emotional process really helped me to have this level of sort of dispassionate investment, but also not hyper close emotionality when I wrote. So
it was kind of these emotions are coming out as you're remembering them, but you're doing it in a very professional way. You're saying because you pick that up as a writer.
I didn't have emotions while I was writing. I mean, I just had concern that I accurately represent the emotions that I had had at the time. Or I would think, okay, I want the reader to believe on page 45, it's not a specific page, but right, believe that people have called me a sociopath. Okay, how do I provide evidence for that so that by the time the reader reads that, they're like, oh yeah, that makes sense given what I've read about this character. So a lot of it really felt pragmatic. I described myself as just an accountant who goes to work, but instead of dealing with numbers and columns, I deal with sentences and dialogue, and the questions felt really technical. And only now do I have any sort of emotional relationship to it, and I just think, like, how did I do that? How did I survive all those things? Like, that was terrible.
And I could tell listeners that the reader will not have the same experience. There's a lot of emotions that will come up as a reader, and I'm sure of it. They did with me. In a blurb on your website, writer Adam Nemeth writes, I highly recommend this book to anyone who's ever been reassured that everything will be fine when they really want others to honor that terror that maybe it won't. It's extremely hard to do for most of us, myself included. We feel the need to stay positive. What were the typical responses from friends and family when you were going through your medical problems? And there were a few, doctor visits and brain surgery.
So the responses really varied. And one of the things that I learned to do was ask outright for the response that I wanted. But I had people who got into at least wars with me, where I would say, I just got this terrible news, my tumor marker rose, and they'd say, at least your legs still work. And I'd say, well, I'm really tired, they don't actually work that well. And they'd say, well, at least your hands work, you're typing, you know, you're typing on your phone. And I'd say, well, I feel really, you know. So I finally realized, okay, that's not somebody that I should go to. So I got this sort of like, at least look on the bright side. I got a lot of what's next, what's next, what's next, what does this mean? How should we feel? Is this good or is this bad? And I could feel this desire for certainty that people had. And I rebelled against that at first very gracelessly, and hopefully with a little bit more grace later on. And that was a really huge one. You know, the wanting to sort of locate oneself in relationship to a tragedy and know how to respond. And I have a section in the book where, you know, I get this news right after brain surgery that I don't have cancer where they thought I did, but I probably have it where they also thought I did. And people around me were exhibiting relief because they'd been expecting a diagnosis that day. And I talk about wanting to know, like, am I relieved? Am I not relieved? Am I more scared because now I just have to wait? Like, I don't know, but I could feel people were like, what a relief, what a relief, what a relief.
And there was quite a bit, a long period of uncertainty after the surgery before you got, I won't give it away, but
right.
Different news.
Exactly.
Or results. Now, your friend Allison, who you mentioned in the very first sentence of the book, had her own medical problems. She's a terminal cancer patient. She passed away a few years ago. And she was the first one to honor your terror that maybe everything won't be fine. Can you tell us a little bit about Allison and her response? And of course, most of the book is about that relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I love that she wanted to be in the whole book, because originally she was just going to have a couple chapters, but she asserted herself on the page. She would say things to me like, oh, this sounds so hard. And of course you're scared. And I remember when I was preparing for brain surgery, I sent out this email to all my friends and I talked to her and I said, oh God, you know, do you think I was just looking for attention? And she said, yeah, because you need attention right now. And she was the first person that I think had enough comfort with her own, I don't want to say comfort with her suffering, but enough familiarity with a life that is really full of suffering, that she wasn't afraid of mine. And then when I saw how she acted when she wasn't afraid of my suffering, I was able to start looking for that in other people and really try to cultivate that and really be with people who could say, you know, this just sounds really awful and I'm so sorry that you're going through it. But she also, you know, I remember one very sort of histrionic day where I'm like imagining my funeral and I'm like, what do you think people are going to say? And she's like, listen, buddy, like, I'm actually dying. We don't know what's going on with you, but nobody has so far said that you're actually on the brink of death. So like, why don't you cool it on your funeral fantasies? And that's what I needed to hear. But she also was able to understand that I was just grasping. You know, I was so confused and demoralized, and she was able to compassionately bring me back.
And there was quite a bit of wisdom and compassion in her. And part of that probably came from her own terminal cancer diagnosis, but there must have been quite a bit of that already in her, I would think.
Yeah, I only knew her sick, but I think that also it's sort of also the product of just a lifetime of personal growth for her and constant sort of togetherness with people. And I think that that had a lot to do with it. But also, yeah, I mean, illness and her husband's illness, I think, taught her a lot.
Now, in a print interview you did with The Rumpus, you make a point that you didn't want to write a primarily illness-focused memoir. What were your reasons for that, for avoiding that, maybe, if I can call it a genre? And what would you say is the primary focus of the book?
So there are some amazing illness memoirs, and I sort of felt like they all say what I would have said. So Two Types of Decay by Sarah Manguso, it describes suffering in a way that is so profound that I don't need to do that work. Barbara Ehrenreich's Brightsided, there's a lot of existing literature that does what I think an illness memoir could have done. And I also really didn't want readers to be sort of turned off by thinking that they were going to read a litany of events that happened at the doctor. I think that we do have a sort of cultural exhaustion with that sort of medical trauma porn, you know, for lack of a better term. And so my focus with the book was really about friendship and the way in which illness was a sort of deus ex machina plot twist in my life that cleared away a lot of the stuff I was trying to work out in therapy, like my fear of intimacy, my perfectionism, I mean, all of which still exist. But it was this great wind that blew in. And then in the absence and in the space that illness created, my friends really showed me how to be loved. You know, my friends like Allison and Lauren and Layla. And I realized later my friends that have always been there. But I feel like the subtitle of the book is against bravery or against teleology. I mean, I'm really against this idea that sick people are in our culture to sort of teach us wise things. And I use this line of like the tourism of illness. And I really wanted to sort of bring that to light and then also question that and also explore the ways in which sometimes I wanted to be the really wise sage. You know, I wanted to be the person who was like, yes, I've been to the abyss. Like, let me tell you about it. But also I just wanted to be a regular 32-year-old, like talking about boyfriends and, you know, going to J. Crew and doing whatever and just showing the sort of multifaceted lives of people who struggle with, you know, in my case, extraordinarily life-threatening illness. I felt very, very, very concerned about how other people were going to feel. And then I had to put that concern aside in order to write the book that I needed to write. But I always thought anytime I introduce another character, right, I talk about my family, I talk about my mom, I talk about my dad, I didn't give them drafts for approval. I just wrote it. But I kept thinking to myself, this is not about their transformations. And so if I have a scene with somebody else, am I responsible for myself and my own actions and my own behavior? And I talked to my friend Adam Nemet, who'd done that blurb, and I asked him, like, you know, is this a burn book? Like, do you think that I mean to anybody? And he said, no, I think you're just really ruthless with yourself, but not with anybody else. But there were also, yeah, I mean, there were definitely things that I think I would have written differently if I existed in a complete vacuum, but thankfully I don't.
Now, you mentioned that ruthlessness, or Adam did, the ruthlessness to yourself. Allowability, of course, extends not just to what other people might want to see in the book, but also what you might not want to reveal about yourself. You write that you had a strong aversion to being vulnerable. How did you come to terms with that?
I had this complication after brain surgery where my pituitary was injured and my body couldn't actually absorb its own water. And so my heart rate would start rising, and at a certain point, I'd have to go to the emergency room. And I didn't know how to drive, and Lyft didn't exist yet. So the only way for me to get the life-saving care that I needed was to ask somebody for help and to, you know, sit there and measure my heart rate, measure my pulse, and then be like, yep, it's like 140. I need to go to the ER. And there were so many times that I felt so ashamed that I needed to go back and that I wasn't over this and that I wasn't stronger. And I would try to meditate my heart rate down. But like, if you're profoundly dehydrated, you can't do that. And so that black and white physical practice and the way in which my friends were unendingly compassionate, let me see, okay, my friends are going to be here when I'm really physically vulnerable. I wonder if they can be here when I'm emotionally vulnerable. And I would sort of titrate in my tolerance for saying, you know, I'm really scared and I don't know what to do. And I was met with love and compassion. And then that let me titrate in a little bit more and a little bit more. And then eventually now, you know, I just am sort of wired from positive experience to live my life out loud, to live my life in public, to go through things publicly. And I keep, you know, I have this fantasy that one day I'll be this like stoic, mysterious person who will allude vaguely to some personal challenges. But like I open my mouth and I'm like, here's my latest MRI. Here's my stage 4 endometriosis situation. Here's what's going on in my relationship. Here's the thing I'm most ashamed of. Like that's just what I do. And that's just my job in this lifetime.
How can listeners find out more about your upcoming events and how to be loved?
So they can go to my website, evahagbergfisher.com. They can follow me on Instagram, where I'm at Eva Hagberg Fisher. And they can also follow me on Twitter, where I'm at Eva Hagberg. But I should say, my Twitter is mostly architecture hot takes. So,
so if they're interested in that, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's great content, but it's not about this.
Thanks very much for coming into KABU, Eva.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking with Eva Hagberg Fisher, author of the new book, How to Be Loved, a memoir of life-saving friendship from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is Ken Jones for KABU's News in Depth. In a New Yorker profile of Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg last September, Evan Osnos writes, "If Facebook were a country, it would have the largest population on Earth, more than 2.2 billion people, about a third of humanity, log in at least once a month. That user base has no precedent in the history of American enterprise. 14 years after it was founded, in Zuckerberg's dorm room, Facebook has as many adherents as Christianity." But there's a dark side to that extensive success. Our next guest, Roger McNamee, is author of the new book, Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, from Penguin Press. And he's joining us by phone live from New York City to talk about the origins of Facebook and what it's become. Roger, thanks very much for calling in. Welcome to KABU.
Hey, Ken, it's a pleasure. KABU is one of my favorites. I visited you lots of times because in my band, Moon Alice, we play in Portland and stop by from time to time when we're there. So it's very exciting to be on the phone with you.
And I am excited to have you on the phone. Not only the book, but I'm also a big fan of Moon Alice. In fact, in your role of rock musician, I've seen the band several times, but of more relevance to the book, you're also a longtime tech venture capitalist going on 35 years. In that role, how did you first get involved with Facebook, and what were your first impressions of Mark Zuckerberg?
So I first met him in 2006. He was 22. The company was 2 years old. And it's, so imagine, this is less than a year after the end of the period described in the Social Network movie. So he's still super young. I got an email from a guy who worked with him who said, my boss is facing a crisis. He needs to talk to somebody who's been around a long time, who's trustworthy, and is objective. Would you take a meeting with him? And I was convinced at that time, even though Facebook was really brand new, it had practically no revenue, it was still just your picture, your name and address, and your relationship status. So there was no news feed. It was nothing like the current product. But I was convinced that because he required real identity, you had to be a student using your school email account. And because he gave you control of your privacy setting, I thought that those were the kind of the magic jelly beans, if you will, that were going to allow him to build the first social network that didn't get overrun by trolls. And so when I first met him, all I can tell you is I had a very positive view, and I was able to help him that day, and that began a three-year period where I was one of his mentors. And my experience with him was fantastic. I mean, he was not, you know, your average person at all. He was socially awkward, but brilliant and idealistic. And in those days, the Mark that I knew was somebody that I admired and liked very much. I didn't see any of the sort of ruthlessness that's depicted in the movie, although I now know that that was there also. It just was never evident in my relationship with him. And so I became a huge fan. I eventually, you know, more than a year later, became an investor in the company on behalf of my fund. And it was the sort of thing where you know, I had a relationship that caused me to be a fan and to help him through some hard moments, but then to sit back, begin 2009, I was no longer involved day to day. And so I just sat back and watched the success, was very proud of it, until 2016, when I began to notice some things going on that really scared the crap out of me, that were really inconsistent with what I had thought was the philosophy and value system of Facebook.
Oh, Roger, I just wanted to talk a little bit more about those early days before we get to that.
Yeah, go for it.
You mentioned his idealism, and he was quoted as saying the goal of Facebook is to make the world a more open and connected place, which sounds very idealistic. Was that the initial mission statement at the startup stage?
Yeah, no, I mean, I always had the impression that he wanted to connect everybody who was online in the English speaking world, right? And you know, I had in my mind, imagine I'm doing this in my Dr. Evil voice. He was 100 million people, right? And you know, in my mind, that would have been enormous, and it would have been very powerful. And I think he could have done that while maintaining the strict discipline on identity and privacy. But what happened was that it became very clear to him, in a way that I did not understand in those days, that if he relaxed the restrictions on identity and privacy, he was going to be able to grow a lot faster and go a lot further. And I remember in roughly 2009 warning him that going for a billion users was going to take him to places that he shouldn't want to go and force him to do things he shouldn't want to do. But I was on my way out, so I wasn't really in a position to help him manage through that. And you know, now that I look back on it, that bothers me. And the reason I became an activist was in part that I felt like this was something I'd been involved in.
Yeah, and I don't want to
I take you on that journey of discovery, that journey which I characterize as being a little bit like the Jimmy Stewart character in Rear Window. You know, I see something that looks like a crime scene, but at the beginning I know nothing. In fact, if anything, I just know positive stuff, but I pull on the thread. And the book is really takes you on that journey of discovery. You don't need to know anything about technology. And by the time you're done, you know everything you need to know. Plus, I then help you understand how to protect yourself, how to protect your children, the kind of messages you should be taking to your elected representatives to ensure that they do what's necessary to.
Now, again, in those early days, and I don't blame you for this, but the problem with Facebook was what's called monetizing you know, all their users at the time. And you were instrumental in getting the person hired who I think was responsible, mainly responsible for that new business strategy.
No, that's true.
That was Sheryl Sandberg, of course, who's currently Facebook's chief operating officer. She was tasked.
And you have to go back in those days. Sheryl was amazing. When I first met her, she was working with Bono. She was at the Treasury Department. She was the chief of staff to the Secretary of the Treasury, and she was helping to forgive the debt of emerging countries around the world that were, you know, had basically been loaned money under terms they couldn't pay back. And by forgiving the debt, she was going to give all of those countries a chance to start again. It was incredibly laudable. And you have to understand, that's the context in which I met her. She and Bono working together to help relatively poor countries get started again. And so, you know, for both her and for Mark, I knew them as idealistic people trying to make a positive impact on the world. And you know, I think it's simply true that sometimes too much success can undermine your values, and I think that happened to the two of them.
Now, she was responsible, again, for that business strategy. There's a recent book called The Rise of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff. She calls Sheryl Sandberg the Typhoid Mary of surveillance capitalism. I wonder if you could explain to the listeners a little bit about surveillance capitalism.
Shoshana Zuboff is a genius, okay? And the book, which is really huge, it's a doorstop, but if you're the kind of person like me who really wants to understand these problems, it's really worth it. It's truly brilliant. Her basic notion is this, that Google had an insight in 2002 that when it was doing what marketers always do, which is gather data from users in order to improve the product that you give to those users. And they were doing that, but they discovered that the search engine threw off lots and lots of interesting data that had nothing to do with improving search. So they did a lot of work to see what it was useful for. And they discovered it had value for predicting behavior across large populations of people. The notion was that you could look at search behaviors of the people on Google and figure out, wow, similar people are going to behave in similar ways over time. And so that caused them to basically realize that the more data they had, the better the predictions would be. So much more data would produce much better predictions. So they create Gmail. And Gmail was cynical two ways. First, because it gave them identity to tie to the purchase intent of search. But they decided to set it up so that they could read all the messages, and people let them do that. People who use Gmail, Google has these computers that scan everything you're doing, looking for, you know, keywords for, you know, that would signal your purchase intent or your behavioral changes. And, you know, take pictures of all the public spaces known as streets and all the private spaces known as our homes. And they simply declare, we own all this content, this data, we're going to make a market in it. Then they take our pictures of our houses from the top, which is what they call satellite view. And then they get in our faces with Google Glass and they take pictures up close. And they simply declare all of these things are now market. We're going to gather all this data and use it to make predictions about each and every one of us. And that marketplace that Google created was something they hid from the whole world. They pretended as though they were doing something very different, that their only goal was to make their ads work better. And in fact, what they were also doing was using filter bubbles, which is when you give people only what they want, and recommendation engines, which tell people, you know, if you like this, you might like that. They took those things and twisted them so that they could make those behavioral predictions come true more often, make them more valuable. And that was incredibly cynical, incredibly dangerous, and that was something that at the time I just didn't see. And Zuboff wrote a book about that whole business model. And when Sheryl went from Google, where she was responsible for growing their advertising business, to Facebook, where she was responsible for creating an ad business, she took that idea from Google to Facebook. And it took Facebook a long time to figure out how to get it to work. It didn't work at Facebook until 2013, which was sadly 4 years after I stopped being involved. So I feel like an idiot now. At the time, I didn't see this, right? And when I talk about being Jimmy Stewart, just like, you know how Jimmy Stewart at the beginning of Rear Window, he's like, no idea what he's seeing. And you sit there and go, wait a minute, that's your neighbor. You should know what's going on. But I was a little bit like that. Just, I was an idiot. And
Roger. The subtitle, of course, is Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. And you were mentioning before that it was the turning point was about the run-up to the 2016 election when you woke up to that catastrophe.
Yeah. First, I saw in January and February 2016, during the New Hampshire primary for the Democrats, a bunch of my friends, initially just one, and then every day more people were sharing photographs with text on them, you know, what they call internet memes, depicting Hillary Clinton in various deeply misogynistic things. And they were all coming from a group that was ostensibly tied to the Bernie Sanders campaign. And it was the kind of stuff that no campaign was going to do putting their fingerprints on. And yet the thing was growing in terms of the number of people spreading these memes so rapidly, it suggested to me that someone was spending money to recruit my friends into this group. And that I thought was really weird and kind of evil. And then that was January and February. Then in March, Facebook expelled a group that was using the advertising tools to gather data about people who expressed an interest in Black Lives Matter. And they were selling that data to police departments, which was really, really evil. And so major civil rights violation. Then in June, I saw Brexit, which was the United Kingdom's referendum on leaving the European Union, where it appeared to me that Facebook's advertising tools were essentially enabling a campaign that had a really emotionally charged, kind of inflammatory message to get much better essentially cost of distribution than a campaign with a neutral message, because in that one the Leave campaign was very xenophobic and the Remain campaign was saying, hey, we got a great deal, stay the course. There was like no emotion in it at all. Then in October, the final straw for me was the Department of Housing and Urban Development cites Facebook for advertising tools that allow discrimination in housing. And that happened, I believe, either the same week or a couple days before we got the news that the Russians were interfering in the election.
Oh, and Roger, I have to cut you off. I'm afraid we're running out of time. And also, you're in the middle of an event, I know, in New York City. It was very generous of you.
No worries.
Well, Roger, again, thanks so much for joining us at Cable.
Talk to you soon.
We've been talking with Roger McNamee, author of the new book, Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, from Penguin Press. Thank you.